session, which I think invokes the ideal that Nate Katz presented us with this morning of a truly interdisciplinary event. As we have this afternoon three very respected speakers from sociology, philosophy, and media. And what is more, they are each going to address what I do think is a truly interdisciplinary topic, namely that of knowledge technology, the technologies of knowledge, which we have, of course, already been discussing also, but will again now. Like the previous plenary session, each of the speakers will talk for 30 minutes, and we will take questions after each of the talks. So I will introduce our first speaker, who I can now, for the very first time in my life, call a colleague, Professor Steve Fuller, who works in the Department of Sociology here in Warwick, is trained in both the history and the philosophy of science, is known for his many books, including a book on Thomas Kuhn, but also is the editor of the journal Social Epistemology, and this is the title I think he uses most for his work. His latest book is Knowledge, the Philosophical Quest in History, and I hand over to you, Steve.
Okay, thank you. Those of you who are at all familiar with the way I operate, I will be periodically typing some words here that will kind of track the kinds of things I'm talking about. What I want to talk about today is something that I've actually not published on directly, but it's something I've been thinking about and working on for a long time, and I thought that this particular group, and I thank Nate for inviting me to speak in a plenary session, would be interested in hearing about. And what this has to do, if you looked at the title of my talk, it has to do with different kinds of ways in which we might think about neuroscience as a kind of scientific technology. And so in the title I draw a distinction between the telescope and the microscope. Now this distinction between these two types of instruments, these two types of scientific instruments, actually goes back a long way. It's a very familiar one within the history and philosophy of science. You might say there's a kind of, I don't want to call it exactly a naive reading, but there's a kind of surface reading of what the distinction is between them. And that's the idea that, both of them make objects visible, and what the telescope does, it makes far away objects that are quite large visible to the naked eye, whereas what the microscope does is make very small objects that are nearby visible to the naked eye. And so in that respect, then, you might think of these two instruments as somehow complementary to each other in the way in which they extend our knowledge. But starting in the mid and late 20th century, a different kind of way of reading the distinction between the telescope and the microscope came about, a lot having to do with the actual function that these instruments played in terms of advancing scientific knowledge. And here I want to step back a little bit and start with a distinction that some of you may know if you're philosophically inclined. Wilfred Sellers talked about two images, the scientific image and the manifest image. Okay, and this is basically, you might say, he's giving a kind of materialist reading of Kant. Okay, but we don't have to go into that right here. But the idea being that the manifest image of the world is basically the world as it presents itself to ordinary perception. And there's a sense in which one can kind of get better at doing that, you know, in terms of using ordinary perception to understand the world. But once we move into the scientific image, there's a sense in which there's a rupture. There's a it's a distinctive way of looking at the world, which is no longer being guided just by kind of the given capacities of the senses, but rather involves some kind of extension or framing, you might say theoretical or technological. And what that does then is it potentially opens you up to a kind of new ontological dimension that would otherwise not be available if you just stuck with the manifest image. Okay? And so the point that that Sellars was trying to make originally, and this was part of a kind of what was known in the trade as a kind of scientific realism argument, was that over time, our sort of folk understandings of things get colonized and replaced by the scientific understanding of things. And so then there's a question about how exactly does this happen? And it's in this context that the distinction between the telescope and the microscope starts to have some purchase. Because in this context, one way of thinking about the distinction is that the telescope, you use a if you think about how the telescope got introduced into science, it was basically to get a better and clearer understanding of objects that you already knew existed. Right? So in other words, the planets, the stars, in a sense, they were already part of the manifest image. And in fact, they played very much a part in people's folk metaphysics and how they understood the way the world worked and so forth. But what they didn't have is a very good detailed knowledge of what was going on in those bodies and how they worked and all the rest of it. And there the telescope actually provided some kind of clarification. And in fact, you know, radical clarification, as the case may be, you know, if you think about Copernicus and Galileo and people like this, radically, but as it were, maybe not exactly unintended consequence, but as a kind of byproduct of the introduction of the telescope. In other words, the telescope was not, as it were, invented to discover whole new ontological realms. It happened to take place, but that was a kind of byproduct of it. Now, the microscope, on the other hand, is different in terms of its conception and how it got brought about. Because actually, nobody had ever seen any microbes or atoms or any of that kind of stuff. Those things are theoretical entities. That's how they began life. They began life as theoretical entities, typically being regarded as metaphysical entities, in the sense that some people were even arguing these things were in principle unobservable. But then what happens is this instrument gets invented. Okay, and the instrument gets invented because the people who invented actually think these things really exist, and all we need to do is to just get something, you know, as it were, extend in a radical way our access to the world, and then this whole new world will open up for us. So that's actually motivating the development of the technology from the start. And this is what the microscope does. Okay, and of course the microscope did do this, and it radically changed, and in a sense, this is very much, you know, this apparatus is very much, in a way, if you want to talk about which of the two instruments has been much more radical in terms of reconfiguring the way in which we understand our world and ourselves, the microscope would have to be said, from an epistemological and ontological standpoint, a much more radical instrument than the telescope. Okay? And so this is kind of where I'm starting from here. I think the key thing here that is an important kind of marker in how we distinguish these two instruments is in terms of whether, is it that we're trying to get a better understanding of something that we already know in outline? So in other words, what we're trying to do is just, as it were, enhance what we've already got, or are we actually trying to open ourselves to a new world where we end up discovering things that we previously did not see? Okay, whether there's an ontological transformation that's being implicated. And I think when we look at something like neuroscience, you have both kinds of impulses operating in the history of neuroscience. And I want to say part of what my argument is, as I develop it more, and I'm not going to be able to develop the whole thing here, obviously, but part of what's going on in the back of my mind as I'm thinking about this issue is not only how one thinks about the way in which neuroscience operates, but also how one thinks about the way, you know, if you imagine the brain, as it were, as kind of a data landscape, right? In a sense, when we think about big data and whatever that is, right, I think there's a similar kind of distinction that one can be operating under here, similar to the one I've just been making between the telescope and the microscope. And so I have both of these things kind of going on through my mind. But let's just deal with the brain example first. One of the things that's quite interesting about the development of neuroscience as a discipline is, of course, the important role that things like probing played in terms of the brain, right? Wilder, Penfield, people of this kind, I don't know how familiar you are. So before we had any kind of neuroimagery, right, we had this idea of probing the brain, right? And this used to be something that was used quite a lot. And part of the, if you actually looked at, you asked neuroscientists, well, what are you trying to do there when you're probing the brain, right? Part of what the answer is actually, is that they're actually trying to get at some kind of memories, ideas, data, whatever, that we don't normally have access to. So in other words, a presupposition from neuroscience at the outset in terms of this kind of probing mentality, which to a large degree has been curtailed for, you know, ethical reasons and all the rest of it, was something like the kind of microscope mentality, right? In other words, there's a sense in which the aspects of the brain to which we normally have access, you know, indirectly admittedly, represents only a small percentage of everything that the brain is capable of. And in order to get the full range of what the brain is capable of, we actually need to go into the brain and start poking around. Okay? And that was always kind of the most, and of course you ended up finding some very interesting things. No doubt about it. Okay? That's been a very strong kind of strand within it's one of the things that made neuroscience in a way very distinctive from psychology, right? Because the thing about psychology, of course, is psychology has always been very much parasitic on folk notions. In other words, we already have beliefs, we already have ideas, we already have these things that in some sense is registered at the linguistic level, you know, in some other kind of behavioral level. And so from the standpoint of psychology, you know, the brain at most would be able to give you the substratum explanation for that, but it wouldn't be really adding much more to the actual phenomena that interests you, because the phenomena that interests you is already there publicly observable even before you look into the brain. Okay? And so in this respect, neuroscience was trying, you know, from the beginning to open up a whole sphere of, that, as it were, a science of brain capacity. Right, and this idea that the brain has this kind of reserve capacity, I mean, you've heard this idea that gets floated around, a very popular idea, that it's a kind of vulgarization of something William James said, right, that we only use 10% of our brains, this kind of idea, right, this is not exactly what he said, but he said something that was sufficiently close to it that it could be misread that way, because he talked a lot about the reserve capacity of the brain, the part of the brain that in a sense we never have the opportunity to exercise, but in principle we could if we just tapped into things. And of course, if you look at the way in which, you know, psychedelic drugs were used and all the rest of it, that was all part of that tradition too. Okay? But this is quite different in a way from the way in which neuroscience has been deployed in the wake of the kind of, the brain scanning revolution. Okay? Because the brain scanning revolution, even though it potentially allows us to actually see a much broader sense of the brain than we were ever able to see before, the way it gets deployed typically, and this is one of the reasons why it causes enormous skepticism among people, is it's basically trying to find a material substratum to things that we already know exist. Right? So even if we're talking, you know, so this is why a lot of the, so the idea of, you know, medical brain scanning is that you already know the person has a disease, now you're trying to find the brain component of it. And that's the part of the whole exercise that interests you the most. You're not particularly interested in what's happening in the rest of the brain or what that might indicate. That is much more like a telescope, right? Where in a sense what you're using the brain scanning imagery for is basically to give you a kind of clear understanding, perhaps some kind of etiological understanding of something that you already have a kind of folk understanding of. But what you're not doing necessarily is challenging the categories, the conceptual categories, under which you have been trying to understand what the person is up to. And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of the brain imagery stuff raises so much skepticism. It's because it looks like it's just reproducing at another level something that we already know to be the case. Okay, you're basically finding, you're basically locating something that in a sense you already know is there. And it's not really a truly kind of exploratory use of this technology. Okay? Now we can. How much more time do I have? Would you say?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay. Well, we can draw a distinction here. Similarly, when we're talking about data-driven, when we talk about big data, there's also a kind of similar distinction that can be drawn between the telescope and the microscope. And corresponding to the telescope is the process associated with what's called data mining, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. And this is a long-standing technique. It predates big data. It basically, you know, big data, at least in this kind of conceptually luminous form in which we talk about it today. But what it goes back to is the idea that if you have a lot of data to look at, but you already know in advance the kinds of things you're looking for, and you believe that you haven't found all of it yet, you can design algorithms or something of that kind to be able to extract those things. And so that's mining, and what you're doing, and one of the assumptions of this metaphor of data mining is that most of the rest of the stuff is just ore, right? So kind of like waste material in some sense and not relevant to what you're doing. And so the value of the data mining algorithm is actually being able to get you exactly what you want, right? Doesn't give you a lot of other stuff that you don't want, okay? So the presumption is it's a very targeted kind of thing. And this is very much like the telescope model. But on the other hand, there's now a different kind of way of thinking about how one deals with big data, and some of you may run across this, and this is the idea of data surfacing, okay? How many of you are familiar with this phrase, data surfacing, as a contrast to data mining? Okay, this is a term that's very much used by the cybersecurity firm Palantir in Silicon Valley. This is their business, basically. Okay, and they're kind of like the microscope guys on big data. And in a sense, what they want you to be able to do is to be able to, as it were, exploit the entire range of data you have for all kinds of possible patterns, especially patterns you may not have thought of looking for. Okay, so in the kind of, you know, crime context, right? So, you know, there's an interesting kind of distinction here that's sort of brewing in the background, right? That when we're talking about the more telescopic approaches to doing neuroimagery or data mining and so forth, very often this is done in a medical context, but when we're talking about a criminal context where there's a much broader remit because one doesn't actually know, you know, where the criminals are and what's motivating them, but we know we've got evidence on them in some way, at least potentially, we need to, as it were, be much more open-minded about the kinds of things we're looking for. And so then what Palantir does, it doesn't just develop algorithms, as it were, that can just mine the data for specified categories, but what it does is it does provide some algorithms, but it also provides a staff member who comes to your firm, let's say the National Security Agency, and actually instructs the people there on how to become more open-minded to the data that's already available. So they begin to be receptive to patterns that they might not have otherwise seen, and in that way they can start making connections, right, that might otherwise have been hidden if they just stayed with their preconceived notions about, you know, the way in which certain kinds of crime or terrorism or whatever takes place. Okay? And it seems to me that this kind of idea, if you go to their website, it's very interesting because Palantir presents itself as a very kind of creative organization. Okay, very creative use of data. Nothing goes to waste. Everything is potentially valuable. Okay, and I'm wondering, you know, in a way to bring this back to the brain example, where we might need to return to that kind of mentality with regard to how we think about the technologies used to investigate the brain. You know, so in other words, one of the things that I would want to put on the table is that we might want to think about the brain not simply as an organ that generates particular kinds of thoughts and ideas that we already know about, but rather a medium for a wide range of expression, very little of which perhaps is being exploited by the normal ways in which we operate in everyday life. Okay, so in other words, treating the brain itself as an instrument that could be exploitable. And I think that is much more in the spirit of what those guys who were initially doing the brain probing and taking the psychedelic drugs were doing, right? To treat the brain as a medium, maybe even as something akin to an artistic medium, let's say, okay? Where there's a lot of experimentation taking place. I say this because I think we are on the verge of developing a lot of technologies that would enable us actually to conduct these kinds of experimental exploratory inquiries onto the brain as a kind of medium. But I think at the moment, our conception of what the brain does, you know, what it's for, as it were, is really quite limited and very much tied to the way in which, you know, brain expression happens publicly through language, through thoughts and ideas and things like that. And so in this respect, I think there's an interesting sort of challenge that I'm kind of moving toward with regard to people who believe, you know, in extended mind. And this is where I turn, Michael is going to be speaking next, and he's a proponent of this idea. Because one of the things about the extended mind, I mean, the extended mind thesis is, it can be many different things. I understand that. But one version of the thesis very often, as it were, tries to distribute, let's say, when you have a thought, not just to something happening in your brain, but to also all these artifacts that you need to use in order for the thinking to be facilitated in some way that's publicly recognizable and somebody can do something with. So in a sense, it's your brain attached to all sorts of technologies, and it's that kind of ensemble that, as it were, is the producer of the thought. It's not just the brain generating it, okay? And of course, there's a lot of truth to this kind of idea if one is doing, as it were, an ethnography of the mind, right? In other words, how the mind is manifested in the world ethnographically. I think this is actually a very good account, this kind of extended mind notion. And so in this respect, I'm very sympathetic. You know, I understand, you know, people coming from the Wittgensteinian tradition are very much on top of this as well. But I do think there is a kind of separate issue with regard to the brain, understood in terms of what its capacities are. There's still that question that's there, right? And neuroscience, in a way, as I said in the outset, neuroscience is not merely providing the material substratum for psychology, however it is expressed publicly or privately, but rather it is the study of the brain in itself. And so there's still that open question about what the capacity of the brain is. So one can talk about, if you recall, the recently departed philosopher Hilary Putnam, right? One of his famous thought experiments from the book Reason, Truth, and History is the brains in a vat, right? The brains in a vat. Now, the interesting thing about this example, right, and this example, Putnam is basically arguing that it would be possible for the brain in the vat to actually have kind of very robust kind of experience and life and things of this kind. And the thing, of course, that comes to mind is, depending on what that brain was connected up to, it could have all kinds of different sorts of experiences and lives and things like this, right? That the brain's capacity, as it were, to experience and to be part of different worlds is really quite much broader than, in fact, the actual worlds in which brains do figure in, right? I mean, I think that's one lesson one would draw from that brains in a vat example, that in a sense, the brain could be doing a lot more. It could be plugged into a lot different sort of network of things. It doesn't just need to be plugged into the network of things that it's currently plugged into. And if it were plugged into these alternative networks, it might actually conjure up a totally different kind of world. Okay? And it seems to me that neuroscience could be dedicated to exploring that, right? The range of possible worlds that could be generated as the brain is connected up to different things, and we can interpret connected up in terms of whether we're talking about connected up to a computer or connected up to a non-computational artifact, a prosthetic device perhaps, or to drugs or anything of that kind. And that could be, as it were, the scope of the science of neuroscience, okay? To explore the entire capacity of the brain and all of the data, as it were, that it could generate connected up to different things. Okay, because at the moment, I don't think neuroscience is quite at that point. Neuroscience is still very much defining its own existence in relation to fields like psychology, where I think, in a sense, it's short-selling the brain. Okay, I'm going to stop here at this point, because this is kind of as far as I've got to my thinking on this. But I think what it raises with regard to the issues that are of interest to people here is that there, you know, when we talk about the problem of big data and all of this unexploited data that's out there and so forth, there's a sense in which this is not just a problem of things generated by computers, but it is a problem that is actually relevant to our understanding of how our own brains work. And there's a sense in which there is a potential here for revisiting what the role of neuroscience is in all of that. And I'll stop here and take some questions. Thank you.
Questions, yes. And like previously, say briefly who you are.
John McManus, postdoctoral associate at the University of Oxford in the Anthropology Department. Thank you very much, it was a very stimulating talk. I just wanted to return to this question of the brain could be doing a lot more to finish on, because it resonates a lot with my personal experiences at the moment. I've recently moved to Turkey, and I'm reminded every single day that the brain could be doing a lot more, specifically helping me to understand and speak Turkish a lot better. And it made me just think also about the experiences of brain plasticity, for instance, but also to do with aging, questions of aging. And I just wondered if you'd thought about issues to do with aging, or brains are not all the same, if you will,
right.
and I just wanted to try and, maybe we should be like pluralizing brains or thinking about brains at different stages of life, and I don't know if any of that has...
Yeah, no, and in fact, the interesting thing, of course, is that as we get better at being able to map the brain, all of this stuff is coming out in the wash, as it were. It's just, I think there's a sense in which our categories are still very much stuck in a kind of social, psychological way of thinking about what the brain does, right? In other words, the categories we use come from a period before we actually knew the full range of possibilities for what the brain can do. And so in a sense, we might actually be a bit blind to these additional possibilities that the brain develops. So we see differences, but we don't know what the significance of the differences are. But I think that would require, significant amount of exploration and experimentation. And I do believe in the current ethics regime, there are some problems with this. So the easiest context in which to explore the sorts of things I'm talking about is if you're dealing with someone who's disabled, basically, right? Because then you can say this is part of a way of remedying or restoring some kind of mental capacity. But if you're not operating in that context, if you're operating with someone who's able-bodied, right, they are, in a sense, we're sort of forced to understand their brains in the conventional categories.
Questions.
There's one up here.
Over there.
Yeah. I'm not sure how clear my question is going to be, but I guess...
Tell us who you are, please.
Yes, right. Yeah. Tyler Wrangler from Brussels, University of Brussels. I guess probably one of the reasons neuroscience was so closely linked also in the first place to clinical psychology and psychiatry, but also because there was, as you just mentioned, a link to pathology or disease or some sort of problem that was that was either medically but also then socially and also experientially defined, classified, experienced. So I guess my question is here is how what would a neuroscience detached from any idea of sort of pathology or disease, or what exactly, what capacities are we talking about? In that, what is the relationship to the norm or the normal, or?
Well, this is the thing. No, I understand your question. It's a good question. No, in a sense, I'm trying to break that, because if you think about where the norms for studying the brain come from, they do come from psychology and from some kind of normal, right, that psychiatry reinforces. All of that, what you say, is true. But I'm saying if we study the brain as an object in its own right, with its own inherent capacities, as it were, independently of those external norms, right, what can it do, plugged in to bodies or to things in different circumstances? So you treat the brain, it's almost like, let's say you invent a computer, right? And you might have an idea that a computer, is something that'll be very useful for you, and you kind of think about the computer purely in those terms, a purely instrumental term, it'll help you out and stuff like that. But then another guy comes along and says, well, actually, the computer's powers are much greater in principle than what you're using it for. It could actually do things that could actually maybe even do them much better than you can, and as it were, maybe even, you know, become a super intelligence. You know, and the project of artificial intelligence in a way has always been toying with that kind of idea. And I'm saying, why not transfer that kind of mentality to our understanding of the brain? In other words, you know, what, you know, and I do think the people who are working on psychedelic drugs, you know, LSD and all this, for better or worse, I think we're kind of tuned into that, actually, right? That there was a sense in which they were interested in the inherent capacities of the brain independently of the kind of presumed norms of what a good brain, what a well-functioning brain is. Go ahead. I'm happy to have him come back.
I guess the problem here is that there's the whole extended distributed cognition too,
yeah,
but also the whole embodied side of it too. And the brain, I mean, people experimenting with psychedelic drugs back in, you know, the cyberneticians were doing that as well, and they were also, I don't think they were experiencing their brain, but they were experiencing their body.
Right, no, exactly.
So that would be,
exactly.
What
no, you're,
can the brain do is also what can the body
do. No, you're absolutely right. And that's why the idea of the brain being plugged into different things. I mentioned this toward the end of the talk, that part of what the remit of neuroscience might be how does the brain react when it is plugged into different sources, as it were, different modes of embodiment, if you will. Right? And that, because you're absolutely right, the brain's got to be connected to something. Right, and it's through by being connected to something that then its capacities are being expressed. But the thing is, the brain could be connected to many different things. It doesn't just have to be in the kinds of bodies that we currently inhabit. Right, and so that would be what I would say on that. But you're right, it has to be connected. I mean, my only issue with the kind of extended distributed mind idea is it tends to be a bit too descriptive. It kind of makes it seem like, you know, what we're connected up to is kind of the extent of the mind, and it doesn't play around enough with the idea of being, you know, connected to different things, and as it were, the mind then changing correspondingly.
We have two more questions, and I think those will be the last two. So first,
So Jeremy Grossman from Namur University, Belgium. It's a very naive question. What would be the difference between the brain and an organ? Couldn't we exploit the possibilities of an arm plugged in or plugged on another body?
I'm not quite sure I get the question.
What's the difference between the brain and other organs?
Oh, sure.
And heart or arms or leg? And couldn't we imagine a science which wouldn't be medical and concerned with pathology?
Sure, no, that's true.
Exploiting other organs' possibilities reflect on other bodies.
No. In principle, what you're saying is correct, but I do think that, in a sense, the brain would be much more interesting. And look, as a matter of fact, we have, as it were, you know, done things to our brains over the centuries that clearly have had kind of effects on what the overall results have been in terms of the way we operate in the world and so forth. Right. And, you know, so even though, you know, you don't have to talk just about LSD, you could be talking about caffeine or alcohol or anything of that kind, and the kind of systemic use of that, how that's changed things. So I mean, I think the reason why to focus on the brain is because I think that there is a sense in which it's a very interesting organ. Obviously, it's been very instrumental in kind of become the way we have come to be. But in principle, what you're saying is true.
Yeah, last question.
No, it's just to really add some support to what you're saying. The neurosciences themselves have a term for this, neurophrenology.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a sort of brain with a concept, and they're looking for the concept. There's a book by someone called Shulman, who I think was an early inventor of fMRI,
uh-huh.
And he criticizes the whole movement through this really famous image of the rat's whiskers.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, each whisker is correlated, or neurocorrelate, with a particular region in the brain. And his argument is, well, yeah, you can see what a sensation is, but then the leap is making that into a concept.
That's right. That's
so, you know, make that into a question. Is that seems to be a very kind of locationist-based kind of philosophy or neurophilosophy. I wonder, when you're talking about a brain being plugged into other things, you know, whether you've got a kind of view of what an anti-locationist philosophy of a brain might look like.
Yeah, I tend to have a view of a kind of more holistic view of how the brain operates. But I think so I'm not against the extended mind thesis. I actually think to get a sense of what's going on, one would have to see the nature of the thing that the brain is connected to. But To be honest with you, I think I can't really say much more until we actually get engaged in this kind of research, to be perfectly honest with you.
And you must have seen the images of the LSD.
Yeah.
Nuts.
Thank you.
By the way, this may be happening in China already, for all we know, right, given the light ethics treatment over there. So we might find out something about what I'm talking about in the next few months.
Yeah, though, I mean, we end on the ethics treatment. I think we will continue the epistemology treatment.